Hi, and welcome to episode number 23 of Circuit Breaker Podcast. I've got special guest Jessica with me here, Jessica Vittorio.
Yes.
So she is a person of the startup community, as well as just entrepreneur extraordinaire and everything else.
I like that title, a person of the startup community. It kind of makes me feel like old school British royalty.
There you go. So who are you and what's your specialty?
So as you said, I'm Jessica Vittorio. I am an attorney based in Dallas, Texas. I specialize in transactional business for early to mid-stage tech companies, but really any type of business. So my practice is solely transactional. I don't do any litigation. I don't go to court, which is probably why I love my job so much. A, I get to wear jeans most of the time, and B, I very rarely deal with people in conflict. There's some conflict involved occasionally, especially if a business is breaking up or ending, something along those lines. But for the most part, you know, my job is to facilitate people working together in some capacity. So that's what I do. And I'm just a person about the startup community, you know, I'm just around.
Right.
Everyone's always like, is Jessica here? What does she do? No one knows. I'm just around.
Right. I think that's both of us.
Yeah.
I get that question all the time too.
I know people always want to be like, do you work for the deck? Capital Factory? I'm like, nope, I just hang out here.
So where are you found most of the time?
My official office is at WeWork in Thanksgiving Tower. Most of the time I can be found in my office at my home, because I am the worst candidate for co-working because I get so distracted. I'm the type of person that will go in and spend 30, 40 minutes talking to someone. And then as soon as I leave that conversation, I talk to someone else for 40 minutes and my day just flies by and is very enjoyable, but I get nothing substantively done. So I try to stay in my house.
And that's on the North Dallas side.
In the Oaklawn region.
Oh, okay. So you're still in Uptown. You're not that far. I thought you were farther north, like up towards us in Plano,
I'm
Frisco.
I'm still kind of near the heart. I'm from Frisco originally.
Ah.
And I do a decent amount of work in the Collin County area. And when I used to be involved in 1 Million Cups Frisco, I was lead organizer when that chapter launched. And so I think that kind of perpetuated this brand that I was based in Frisco. That, and I am really active with the city and the school district. So a lot of people think that, but I'm not actually. I'm based in Dallas.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense now.
See, once again, no one knows. No one knows. It's like where they're like, where's Adam? I'll be like, no one knows.
Yeah.
I mean, I know now because I'm here, but
right.
I won't tell all of you.
It's a secret location.
We're a secret filming location somewhere in the Dallas area.
So, okay, based on that, so one of the other things about this podcast is always somebody who's building something. And one of the big things that's been happening this year is everybody's breaking into their own podcasts or LinkedIn videos or all sorts of other stuff.
That's true.
And so the reason we met at a City Central event, and I'm like, oh my God, I know your name and I don't remember why. And then I was like, oh yeah, you had the really cool podcast name.
Yeah. So I have a podcast called Shit Your Lawyer Says. It essentially focuses on demystifying legal concepts as they relate to business. So taking all of those words or phrases that are thrown about the community, but people have a tendency to use wrong, or not fully understand what they mean. It's those things you say and you kind of inadvertently end with a question mark in a conversation. You're like, oh, it's a non-compete maybe. And you're like looking for some reinforcement that that's correct. So I try to work people through that and just give entrepreneurs and business owners a point of reference. You know, it's not legal advice. It's really meant to provide you a starting point for a conversation with your own attorney, so that you don't go to them and say, you know, as we've talked about, I had a lot of clients at first that would come to me and use very specific terms and say, I want a very specific document. And they would say it with confidence. So I said, okay, that's fine. I can do that. And we get this document drafted and then they're really unhappy with it. And I'm like, I don't understand. You specifically asked for this document, stupid young lawyer Jessica's. Like, you specifically asked for this document, and I gave you this document, and now you're unhappy. And the problem is, they were using words they didn't really know what they meant. And so they were asking for something that was not really what they needed. And, you know, part of that is age and professionalism. You learn how to counsel people more. But I think the other side to helping solve that problem is to educate business owners and the public as to why those terms of art are important and what they mean. And especially in investment contexts, as we've talked about, you know, I see founders all the time who I think accidentally misrepresent potentially their intellectual property rights or the status of those rights because they try to talk about very technical terms of art in using general language. And occasionally those things can constitute misrepresentations and investment situations. So you want to be very careful and be aware of the situations where you need to be conscious of the language that you're using.
That makes sense. And so one of those things where I think you hit on two things, right, is for me, every time I talk to somebody like you, a lawyer of some sort, and it always in my back of my head, and this is after years of dealing with lawyers as well.
Is having the pleasure to deal with lawyers.
it's good and bad, and there's a longer history on that. Yeah. But the thing is what you just hit on, right, which is counsel, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you're supposed to be there to counsel. Mm-hmm. And so how has that 100%. Changed everything that you kind of do and you provide education? Because you're working your way backwards, right? It's the same thing. From my end, every time I get an engineering contract of some sort, they're like, we want to do this with this. And I'm mm-hmm. like, wait, whoa, stop, hang on. And I'll catch myself on that on a regular basis is, I'm like, yeah, you can use this controller and this kind of LED and this kind of, wait, hold on. Wait, what are we trying to accomplish, right? So is that the same approach that you take? And how much counsel are you learning that you're providing now over actual substantive thing?
I think the best thing an attorney can do is set your clients up for success going forward, right? I mean, I don't want to, you know, work myself out of a job, but at the end of the day, I want to set my clients up for success with or without me. And that requires that they have a certain level of education and understanding about their own business. And so my job is to, you know, provide some of that education. When I walk through like a first major contract or operating agreement bylaws with a client, I, you know, meticulously will walk through provision by provision with them and make sure they understand what those provisions mean, not just for this contract, but so that when they see those in the future, they at least have some point of reference for what that means. Do I think they're all going to sit down and read every single document that they ever sign or look for these specific provisions? No, I don't. At the end of the day, that's still what I'm there for. But they can make and have an educated understanding of the types of contracts that are coming onto their desk. And so I think to the extent that an attorney you're working with isn't providing you some level of education and is trying to keep all of that education to themselves to kind of protect their hourly billing, that to me is honestly BS. Like, part of my value to you is the education that I'm providing. If you went into the doctor and I said, hey, you know, every time I run in cold weather, I have an asthma attack. And they just said, okay, here's an inhaler. And they had no conversation with me about, you know, are you a smoker? Do you do any of these things? Like background information that may be helpful, education that I may need to mitigate that situation going forward. And they just prescribe something and give me kind of an end result. Like you said with your clients, if you just produce an end result without giving them any sort of education or context as to the process, then you're not really fulfilling your job. And to be fair, the title attorney gets thrown around a lot, but the official title is counselor at law.
And that's why I learned that is every time I've had it. And that's why I love the title general counsel over over anything else, because you're providing us a general counsel of some sort.
And the other thing I think is really important about that is I see a lot of deals go bad sometimes because inexperienced founders and business owners will use counsel that actually don't have any industry expertise. So for example, if I were to walk into a situation with a photographer, I don't have any background in photography contracts. That's not to say I can't read the contract and tell you what's in it, but from a counseling perspective, I have no point of reference for what's industry standard and what's not industry standard. Whereas if you're a tech company negotiating some sort of private equity deal, I have the industry experience to know, you know, discount rates and all these other sorts of preferred rights and returns and things like that. I can give some actual industry counsel as to what these people are asking for is not industry standard. At the end of the day, my role is never to say take the deal or don't take the deal. That's for your board, your business advisors, whoever. But I can say I've looked at 50 of these agreements and I can tell you that this provision is not standard. And I've seen attorneys who don't have industry experience give really bad counsel and take tank deals because, you know, they make the other party out to be screwing over their client when really that's not the case at all. A lot of what they're asking for is industry standard, or in some cases even better than industry standard. The problem is that attorney has no point of reference for that. And so they're not taking that into account. So that's something that I think it's important to find someone not only that does business transactions, if you're dealing in business transactions, that does business transactions as their primary practice, but also does have experience in your industry. And a competent professional and attorney should know what those limitations are for themselves.
One other thing I've noticed over and over again, especially on the attorney side, is, and this is from learning on the other side of it, right? Being on the client side, is communication, right? So mm-hmm. if you're willing to pick up the phone and just talk to the other client, yeah. the other side, the other, even if their attorney is or is not present, which I mean, it just varies depending on the situation, right?
Yeah.
But it's also, oh my God, this is big and scary, when it's, in fact, you're just trying to figure out what the ultimate intention is. Sometimes you put stuff in, and again, going back to what you originally said with original, oh, well, I think I need an NDA because of whatever, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, wait, hold on, what's the intention, mm-hmm. right? Ultimately, the intent is going to drive and derive whatever you're going to do.
Yeah.
And how many times have you seen that miscommunication has blown up all sorts of stuff?
Yeah, miscommunication between the lawyers and the client, and also miscommunication between the clients originally. So those two parties, I think that's part of the reason to get lawyers involved, because my job is to make sure that what you want is what's articulated in the document. But also I see that a lot, and I won't name any specifically, but online legal document services, this happens all the time where the document that is created is just not reflective of the agreement that the parties had, because there are limitations to those types of services. And in my opinion, they're not very clear about those limitations. And so a lot of people are misled to understand what those limitations are. But I see time and time again, and it's always, you know, in some sort of emotional crisis, right? Like, you realize that the document isn't reflective of the deal when you want to split up the business and everyone is super pissed at each other. And now you're not going to have an unemotional conversation about how to do it. Now you have to take it to court because you have this document you spent money on that you know, both sides normally realize is not at all reflective of what we wanted. So now we have to go battle in court about what it is that we originally wanted and agreed to. I see that all the time. And so making sure, yeah, that you're, you know, my style to my relationship in counseling my clients is I have kind of an open phone, open door policy, right? Like, call me, text me, email me whenever, unless I physically have to go look something up in like a code or a case or whatever the situation is. I don't charge my clients to do that. I don't bill them for that time. The reason being, I would rather have them ask me on the front end than make a silly decision that is going to cost a bunch of money to clean up on the back end. And, it will stop business owners from reaching out if they know that they're going to be charged for those things. And it's so silly, right? Because you can save yourself so much money. But it's just not, I think, in the client's best interest in the long term to kind of nickel and dime over little things like that. And also, it's about formality, right? I spoke on a panel at the State Bar Conference, which is like the big conference for all the lawyers. Last year, or this year, I guess. And one of the questions from the audience was, do you text clients? And I said, I was the only one on the panel that said yes. And to be fair, my attorney, my style as an attorney is very non-traditional.
Which lends you more towards the startup scene, because we're all trying to disrupt something or other.
Yeah, for sure. It fits very well with my client demographic. Mm-hmm. But I said, yeah, I text my clients. And that made some of the other attorneys uncomfortable. Just like my wearing jeans every day makes a lot of attorneys uncomfortable, and my hourly billing rate makes a lot of attorneys uncomfortable, and all these things. But here's my argument, and that is, I can only be as effective at counsel as the information my clients provide to me. If they don't want to talk to me because they're kind of emotionally standoffish, or they feel like I'm going to lecture them, or they feel like they're talking to a parent, I can't be effective at my job.
Correct.
That's the end of the story. So whether that means I have to text them, or I have to wear a t-shirt every day, or whatever the situation is to make them comfortable, that is my job, right? That's what I have to do, because maybe wearing a $5,000 suit every day makes me feel really, really good. But if it makes my clients uncomfortable, well, then it's impeding my ability to be a competent professional. And to be fair, I prefer to wear t-shirts and jeans. But either way, I mean, you have to speak. And there's 100% clients that are the opposite of that, right? Like, you look to more conservative industries, banking, real estate, things like that. Those industries would not respond well to my style of counseling.
Right, but that's not your style of...
Yeah.
Again, going back to specialty and industry experience and everything else.
100%.
So related to all that stuff and your growth as an attorney and your firm and everything else and this podcast you're starting.
Yeah.
What's 2019 bringing you, considering we're right at the tail end?
I know.
This is probably the last one I'll post for 2018 as far as a podcast.
I'm just finishing out the year. Wow. Okay. I'll try to make this a very exciting episode.
No worries. There's all sorts of crazy ones.
I'll share all of my best thoughts. What is happening in 2019? So the podcast, I did 4 episodes when I originally launched, and learned a lot in those 4 episodes, as I'm sure you're aware of. I think it's funny you say everyone's jumping into podcasts, because that's 100% accurate. There are these people that... like yourself and like people that have been doing podcasts for a while that are very professional and proficient at it. And then there's people like me who have a stupid idea one night, and the next thing you know, I have a freaking podcast and have no idea what they're doing or technical background to like support that endeavor.
No, but I think it's great. Honestly, this is the same thing as YouTube and everything else. I think there's a place for democratization.
Yeah.
I think it will fix a lot of problems in the industry, but that's a longer conversation.
Yeah, for sure. So I think it's a learning curve, which is what I tell everyone. I like to consider myself a competent person generally, and pretty like quick to pick stuff up, but the learning curve was a lot larger than I anticipated. So I did 4 episodes and got some great feedback. I learned a lot about my own recording style. You know, my first episode was very heavily edited. I would even edit to the point where I was like editing out every time I said, like I literally went through the entire thing. So time inefficient. You're going to have to edit that out. I hope you go back through. Okay. We're stopping with that.
This is entertaining.
I know. I wish everyone could see me like getting angry at myself. I feel like my speech and debate coach from high school would throw a tennis ball at us every time we said,
so I feel just, like that's, you can dodge wrench, you can dodge ball.
Yeah, 100%. I'm just waiting to dodge the tennis ball. I am just giving up on this point. So anyways, the podcast, I am relaunching kind of at the beginning of the next year, and I'm going to bring in some guests, which is exciting. So my background is in transactional business, and I talk about a lot of general business concepts, but I'm having some kind of parallel specialties come in. So there is a tax attorney that I'm interviewing that's going to talk about some tax stuff. There's an intellectual property attorney that's going to talk about fair use and just some commonly.
Here's the one that, like, and I just said like, so it's, you know, no better than that. I'm going to sound like a valley girl for a little while.
This is what we're going to talk about for the rest of the episode now.
Exactly.
I've really taken it downhill.
it's perfect, right? It's just like, it's the year's over. Yeah. I'm done. Walking away.
The tone for the end of 2018.
Exactly. Yeah, this year's been just walking been a away. Roller coaster. Yeah, just walking away from this year. So the thing I was thinking is one thing that I've never heard, and I've only seen one friend of mine who's an attorney that's fairly the only one who specializes in it, actually, is estate law, right? So that's mm-hmm. another thing that there have been big profiles of, for example, Oculus, right? The founder of Oculus got hit by a bus.
Yeah.
Literally, unfortunately, and was taken out. And even with 2018, we've seen a lot of losses. And so now we're looking at that and saying, okay, if that's the case for a loss, what happens to the business next, right? So that's that's a transactional thing that needs to be built in. And a lot of times in operating agreements, what's survivability look like? What's things like that look like?
Yeah.
How do you handle estates
and
estate law in that sense?
There, I generally address a couple of situations with my companies, death, disability, divorce, and then significant addiction issues. So all four of those things are generally in most agreements. Some people choose not to address them, but making sure, because things like divorce, people don't even think about. I mean, Texas, we're in Texas and my license is in Texas. So Texas is a common property state, right? Everything in the estate is assumed to be common property of both both spouses, and I'm generalizing here, so you family attorneys don't send me a bunch of nasty emails like that is a misstatement of the common property laws, making generalizations. So it's assumed to be common property unless you can show that it's separate property. And so if I start a business in the middle of our marriage and I hold 50% interest in that business and then my business partner owns the other 50%, if I get divorced, that asset, my 50% ownership, can get split up just like the interest in a house or cars or whatever it is. So suddenly, if you don't have a provision in your operating agreement that addresses divorce and what happens in the event of divorce, your business partner can end up running the business with you and your ex-spouse, which I always joke that what's the likelihood you're going to make a business work if you couldn't make a marriage work? But I mean, there's some truth to that, right? Yeah. You don't, especially as the business partner, want to have to be playing middleman for these two spouses in the midst of what potentially could be kind of an emotional, nasty situation.
Right. And that could also hang up transactional other issues, right? Yeah. So now you have a partner that's really not wanting to have an interest really in something that, for whatever reason, emotional or not, they don't want to see it succeed, or they do want to see it succeed for some other reason or something like that.
Well, and the other thing to be careful of with those provisions is I see a lot of times that they're automatically triggered. So if I get divorced and my spouse gets half of my interest, so 25%, the company is now required to buy that 25% automatically. And I also don't think that that's always the greatest option, right? What if the company doesn't have the cash on hand at the time to buy that 25% and there's no way to address that, or that's not addressed in the operating agreement? Or what if, you know, it ended amicably and they're actually okay, all three of us running it together, we've decided that that's not terrible, and we don't want to spend the cash to buy them out right now. I mean, all of these situations. So I think putting the option to deal with all these situations in and giving the company the option to exercise certain repurchase rights or whatever it is great. But I'm also not always a fan of requiring repurchase or redemption or whatever the situation may be.
Right. Well, we've got like 5 minutes left.
Man, time flies.
I know. I usually keep it about 30 minutes.
And I like it.
We're pretty much almost there.
We're almost getting there.
Which is great. It's like the year. So what else are you up to? So you've got this podcast you're working on. Anything else big that you want to share that you're or excited about or tease or anything else?
Yeah, I'm hoping to get... I don't really fancy myself a content creator, but there is some content-based stuff that I'm hoping to get out into the world in 2019, for better or worse. We'll see how amused people are with my shenanigans. Sometimes I have people ask me, because the bar is very low for like social media influence in the legal profession. So attorneys come to me all the time. They say, oh my gosh, your social media presence is awesome. And that makes me laugh very hard because I work with influencers as clients all the time. And I know my social media is terrible. They're like, what's your strategy? That's what they say. What's your strategy? And my answer is quantity over quality, generally. Just like the first thing out of my head.
Which, okay, so here's a question I have. And I know you and I were talking about transparency earlier, right? Yeah. Related to this. Is you're required to put ads in front of this council. This like this magical, advertising scary council that nobody knows. Yeah. It's like the MPA, right? We don't know how those...
It's just like a guy behind a screen.
Right. So with social media, how does that work?
Yeah. Social media is kind of a weird gray area. I believe the current rules, and to be fair, I should know this for sure because I'm on the law practice management committee. Uh-oh. So fellow committee members, please do not send me nasty grams after this.
She's looking it up, like she said earlier.
I'm just going to Google it right now. But if I'm writing like a blog and the blog is for my firm website, technically all of those are supposed to be approved. However, my social media is all under my brand personally. It's not under my firm sites. So that's kind of how I legally and politely toe that line. I'm going to make myself a target for the advertising review committee now. But to go back to fees, I do think that's something that's really important to take into account. All of this background industry stuff that happens in every industry, like we were talking about photography, and artists have to deal with this a lot. You know, every time I put out an advertisement, I'm supposed to submit it to a committee to be reviewed. And every time they do that, I have to also send a check for $100. So there's an overhead fee, right? I have to pay the state bar, my bar dues every year, which is a fee that I have to pay to keep my license. I have to pay for continued learning education credits every year.
An office. Okay, outside of that, what other fees do you have to pay?
I mean, I don't really pay for any form of advertising. Most of my advertising is just self-promotion, my personal brand related stuff, the podcast, even though the podcast isn't officially affiliated with the law firm either, because if it was, technically I would have to get it approved.
How long does this review process take?
I don't really know because I've never done it. I think that it probably takes them about a week or two. I know that you have to, like, for example, my website only has specific information that's statutorily allowed for me to not have to submit my website for approval.
Right. It's like me being a notary. I'm only allowed to say certain things as a notary.
Yeah. But if I went outside the scope of those things, I would have to submit my website for review. And to do that, I don't actually give them the link to my website. I print out the landing pages and send them to the advertising review committee, because this is how the legal industry operates, is things like this.
Wait, so hold on. Then if that's the case, and I know I'm picking on social media, and I know we're going into a danger zone, but the question then becomes, if you're posting
Yeah.
Right?
Do you have to get every post approved?
Well, not only that, but then at what point does social media become irrelevant, right? Because social media, the whole point is immediacy, right? Like
100%.
We have to respond back to certain things. I mean, in other industries, talking about like FAA and the airline industry, right? If you have a social media presence, FAA now requires you to be able to respond on that social media presence as well and make sure that the customer is okay.
Yeah.
So if a customer tweets you, you have to at least respond back and attempt to figure out what the hell is going on with that customer and why they're being crazy.
Yeah.
So in that case, how does that become anywhere relevant? Because if I'm starting to print out tweets, then that tweet is no longer valuable. Yeah.
Well, I think that's why you don't see a lot of firm engagement on social media platforms. You may occasionally see a Facebook ad, which they've submitted for approval. But, and to be fair, these rules vary by state. So I'm only talking about the state of Texas rules. But yeah, you don't see, like, my firm does not have a Facebook page, because if it did, you don't have to get approval to repost outside content. So a lot of the firm pages you see, if you're paying attention, the only thing they're doing is reposting third-party content. They're not really creating any content. Or if they are creating content and it's through the firm page, it's supposed to be approved.
Oh man, I see shenanigans happening here.
Yeah, it just, I mean, the entire system is really outdated. And it is a huge, in my opinion, and I've said this before at professional industry level stuff, it's a huge disadvantage for solo and small firm practitioners, because the big firms, the top 10 firms, don't need social media engagement because A, it's not their target demographic, and B, they already have the name recognition from being around so long.
Right.
The people that need it are the solo and small firm practitioners, and they're the ones that A, can't afford to get in trouble with the bar for things like that, and because if you're found to be in violation, that's a $300 fine. So, I mean, you can rack up fines pretty quickly. And not that I've ever heard of anyone, I haven't really asked anyone, but I haven't heard of anyone racking up a ton of fines. But it's discouraging to solo and small firm practitioners from being able to utilize to the fullest extent social media advertising.
Well, and that's unfortunate too, because if you're discouraging people, right, and then also you're now stopping the education that we're circling back to, right? So now you're not even able to educate your clients and consumers and actually provide them correct counsel, because a lot of times they're going to learn it off of social media and off of various other platforms and then come to you going, I need this.
Well, yeah. I mean, in the world of the internet, where just like a doctor, my biggest hurdle is overcoming whatever it is my client Googled that I now have to like address and either explain to them why it's not accurate or applicable. It's like the legal equivalent of someone WebMDing themselves. It's like, oh, okay, now I have to deal with this too. But the only way to combat kind of...
So there has to be a web JD now created?
I swear, if someone comes... I mean, there are essentially variations of it. I think you could argue Avvo has a component that's similar. I think UpCouncil has a component that's similar.
LegalZoom.
Yeah, LegalZoom probably has a component that's similar. All these, like, web-based services, they have their own kind of Google search engine components. So, yeah, people go and... None of that is to say that the information is inaccurate, but the problem is, especially for business, it's a state-by-state issue. So if the person writing the article is in Florida, great, maybe that's 100% accurate for Florida, but we're in Texas, and the laws aren't the same in Texas.
And we don't catch our cars on fire in the Taco Bell drive-thru.
Well, I don't know that I want to go that far, because I live next to a Taco Bell drive-thru, and I feel like... occasionally some stuff happens there that you wouldn't expect. So if I looked over and there was a car on fire, I'd be like, yeah, okay, that makes sense to me.
Well, on that note, I'm excited
on the car fire note.
I'm excited for your shenanigans.
Thank you.
What else? Is there anything else you want to plug for next year?
No, I mean, I have some speaking engagements lined up for 2019. Other than that, I'm just looking for... I just like hanging out in the community and honestly seeing what everyone else does. So I'm just... planning to be around ambiguously, like everyone already associates me with being around ambiguously.
So now we actually know what she does.
She just wanders around. Everyone's like you. I'm hoping my goals for 2019 include wandering around ambiguously with Adam.
Uh-oh. That's dangerous.
Trouble. Be on the lookout.
Right. So we're going to start lots of trouble, which there is something that I will announce probably that I know I'll pull you into.
Great.
And we'll go from there. But thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's been fun to chat.
One other question. Where can people find you? And I will put links to this.
Where can people find you? So my firm website is www.lawofficeofjessicavittorio.com. I wish everyone could see the face Adam is making at me right now. And it's funny because my email address, Jessica@lawofficeofjessicavittorio.com, when I made it, little 23-year-old Jessica, or however old I was, was like, this is logical because people won't have to guess, like, what are the letters that are in her firm name? And also my initials are JV. So JV Law Firm is a terrible name for a law firm. So that was never going to work. Anyways, so I have a very long email and web address. You can find me on LinkedIn at Jessica Vittorio, Facebook, same thing, Instagram, J Jess Vittorio. Things I should know. Don't find me on Instagram. It's fine.
Well, I was going to say, we'll put those links in the show notes.
Yeah,
right?
Great.
And the other thing is, where is this other podcast of yours? Is it on?
It's on Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, and YouTube and SoundCloud.
Not iTunes yet?
Not iTunes because it's shit your lawyer says, self-censored, expletive, first word. Their new guidelines require that I take that out.
Really?
So, yeah, I have to update the logo, amend the name to be able to upload to iTunes, and I just haven't
done that yet.
Yeah, I got a real quick rejection from Apple.
Wow.
Like within a couple hours. And I had no, I mean, with my vast podcasting knowledge that I started with, I had no idea. So it was very shocking to the entire Shit Your Lawyer Says community.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Well, we'll put those links out in the show notes for
awesome.
Sure.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun. I like an excuse to chat.
Exactly. It works.
Yeah, it works.
Cool.